I teach Hebrew and Old Testament at Garrett Evangelical Seminary in Evanston, Illinois, and this is the seventh of nine studies on the book of 1 Samuel. We're a little past halfway through. We haven't done all of it, and there'll be enough reference to things that we've done before. If this is your first time here with me, that you won't be too lost. Even people who have been with me in every session are sometimes lost. And that's usually my fault and not theirs, so take heart. Today we're going to look at David and Saul's kids. We were finally full-blown into the shift from interest in Saul to interest in David in the story of 1 Samuel. Reminded of Joseph Heller, that's the guy who wrote Catch-22, right? Heller? He wrote a book called God Knows, so half dozen years ago, and it starts off with David on his deathbed, railing for Bathsheba because she was a real woman, and she wouldn't come see him until he promised to give Solomon the throne, and complaining that the two books of Samuel were named Samuel, and Samuel was never king, according to Heller, as he tells the story, David as Heller tells the story. And three-fourths of these two books, half of 1 Samuel, and almost all of 2 Samuel, is about David. And so why is there no 1 and 2 David? David, as Heller portrayed him, felt really cheated by this naming business. I think there's some good reasons for this. But we won't get a chance to get into the most of the really tacky stuff about David is in 2 Samuel. But there's some tacky stuff that happens to David, and I think the material that we'll look at today in 1 Samuel 18 and 19. And you get a sense in these stories of David as an extremely charismatic, in the sense that we use it today, and in the sense that it's used theologically, and that is, like, someone that you shake his hand and you kind of feel a buzz in your hand. You see him walk, he walks into the room and all the heads turn. Everybody notices when he comes in. And in the sense that there's some sort of gift from God that just can't be explained, that goes beyond this sort of what we would call political charisma. Every 4 years we look around in the as the Iowa primary and the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary get going, they keep telling us about who's charismatic and who's not. You know, Mike Dukakis couldn't get elected dog catcher now because we all know he's not charismatic. Walter Mondale couldn't get elected anything other than ambassador because that's an appointed position because he's not charismatic, which in the political realm is anathema. David had this, apparently had this sort of charisma because all of these kids who were in line to be queen regent, or actual, Jonathan had died, I should say, Jonathan, who was heir apparent, was in line to be king, Merab, one daughter that we'll only hear mentioned briefly, and then Michael, who actually marries David, is in line to be queen regent. They give everything up to David. It's like, here, take it. You're like, open your wallet and give it all away. And it's fairly interesting.
Was David really a redhead?
The text says that he was ready. And I don't know if that means that he's a redhead or, you know, some people think ready means red hair and others don't. Let's start with a brief word of prayer. Gracious God, you give us all gifts, some which we appreciate and some which we fail to see even in ourselves until others help us. You give those around us gifts, sometimes we fail to see them. We want things for ourselves and for our families that might not fit. Give us the grace to release them from our expectations. These things we ask in the name of your Son. Amen. Mm-hmm. Let's just start in reading the text and see what the story tells. I'm going to give you one more piece of background. I mentioned briefly that Jonathan is the heir apparent. He's the only son that gets mentioned with any regularity in Saul's line. And beginning about in chapter 13 of the first book of Samuel, so about six chapters before we pick up, he is repeatedly mentioned as an extraordinary warrior and a wonderfully brave man, which is the kind of characteristic that the Israelites at this point in their career wanted as their leader. That continues into today. One of the big pieces of flack about Bill Clinton was not only that he was a war protester, but he had no military experience. I mean, it would have been bad enough had he just not had any military experience, but he went a step further and was a war protester. So it was very important that he get Al Gore on his ticket, sort of balance things out since he was running against the war hero. And it is extremely rare, I don't know if we've ever in the United States elected anyone else who didn't have at least some military experience. I was guessing maybe FDR.
That's what I was wondering. Yeah. Did he?
Sorry, he was some security.
Yeah, he did.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Abraham Lincoln was just was only a reservist.
He's only a reservist.
Yeah.
But we have to sort of look around. Everybody else, we can pretty quickly point to their experience. Whether or not they were good presidents is another matter. But we continue to look to military leaders, military experience as a form of leadership, because, in fact, government has always been about preserving boundaries and resources for a national group. But Jonathan has been established in the text. The kinds of stories that we tell about Jonathan going up in Michmash and running, you know, sort of running out headlong and risking his life and the life of his men, but coming up on top, because as Napoleon said, I'd rather have lucky generals than smart ones. He's portrayed as the kind of person who's right there ready to be king after Saul, whenever that time comes. Yesterday we looked at David showing up a couple of times in Saul's household, apparently stories that were put together from different traditions. And now we see Jonathan meeting David for the first time immediately after killing Goliath and dragging his head into the king. Would someone pick up in 18, 1 through 5? 1 Samuel 18, 1 through 5.
When he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan had submitted to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David and his armor, and even his sword with his bow and his guide. And David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul set him over the men of war. And this was good in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servant.
Great. So this charisma that we talked about, that I talked about, we see it with this other wonderfully brave warrior Jonathan, who knows who's been being set up in the narrative as the heir to the king. This giving and stripping himself of his robe and his armor, his sword, and even his belt, I think is symbolic. Usually when we see specific mentions of changes of clothing in the Hebrew Bible, it indicates a change of status. And what I think is happening here is Jonathan is already acknowledging, you know, I have the armor and the tools of war of the heir apparent, but it's clear to me that this is who you are. And he takes this stuff and just gives it over to David. It could also just be a gift of a pledge. Often when people made But covenants with one another, there'd be an exchange of gifts. But there's no indication that David reciprocated it in any way. It seems to be from Jonathan to David. And so I'm more inclined to believe that this is, at least in the editor's eyes, or the teller of the story, is letting us know that Jonathan knows who the next king is to be. And that becomes clear as we move through the story, that Jonathan is, at this point, maybe he never was interested in being the next king of Israel. King, remember, kingship is a new thing in Israel, and they don't quite know how it works, because Saul is the first real king that they have. Any questions or comments? Yeah?
Did we say anything about the chronology? Is this relatively soon after the Goliath story, or could it be many years later?
It's hard to tell with Hebrew narrative, because you get connecting phrases that aren't as concerned with time, or aren't as specific about time. They're more as we are in Indo-European languages. So the text, the people who told the story, I usually call them the editors, will put two stories next to each other to give you a sequence that may or may not have been as close as it actually was. All right, as close as it looks in the text. So the story, this narrative picks up when David began, or when David finished speaking to Saul. That might be a connective phrase to put the story of David's reporting to Saul together with the introduction to Jonathan. But as the story reads, they're right back to back. So Jonathan is there when David comes in. This terrible threat is eliminated, and here's a real hero. We already know David's a wild man, or Jonathan's a wild man, but he wouldn't go out and fight the lion. Maybe he wanted to. You know, we just, like I said yesterday, we don't get much internal motivation, and Jonathan doesn't even show up in the Goliath narrative. Let's, if someone would pick up in 6 through 11.
And they were coming home when David returned from slaying Philistines. The women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul, timbaled with songs of joy and with instruments of music. And the women sang to one another as they made merry. Saul had slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. He said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands. And what more can he have but the kingdom?" And Saul eyed David from that day on. And on the morrow, an evil spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house. While David was playing his lyre, as he did day by day, Saul had his spear in his hand. And Saul cast the spear, for he thought, "I will pin David to the wall." But David evaded him twice.
A couple things happen here that we need to take a peek at. This poem here, let me start in one sequence. It seems that the atypical role of women in times of warfare in the ancient Near East was to write, or it's a better word here since they weren't writing, create and sing the victory songs. We see it at Exodus 15. Miriam's the first one to lead the Israelites in worship after they've eluded the Egyptians. And that short song of the sea there. Yahweh's a man of war, a horse and rider, he's thrown into the sea. Miriam leads the women out in song, called a victory hymn. And here we have the victory hymn that the women lead out to welcome them. Sort of like martial cheerleaders. That trivializes it, but it's a it's a role that the women play in the culture, in addition to the other roles that they play in supportive warfare, but to welcome the men back from the battlefield and sing their songs of victory. This one is a fairly typical Hebrew poetry pattern. It's called the basic element of Hebrew poetry is not rhyme or meter, as we think of in Western poetry, but parallelism, repeating similar ideas or contrasting ideas, or in this case, it's called step or ascending parallelism, where you start with one number, in this case thousands, and then in the next line go to a higher or a geometric climb, and this and then 10,000s. You see at the beginning of Amos, three things that the Lord can't abide, yea, four, and then they go on to list them. You see it lots in the Proverbs. There are three things that man cannot understand, yea, four, and then they go on to list them. And this seems to be one of those pieces. More than comparing David, it would seem, on a poetic basis, they're not really comparing David. They do give David the ascendant piece, but how many people did he kill here? He was a big guy, but he wasn't 10,000 times as big as anyone else. So this is, if this poem actually fits in this place, is original to this place, it's not meant to be literal, it's meant to be poetic. David's the hero today. But even that is problematic for Saul, as we see. And his response is, look at this guy, gets the ascendant position and the victory hymn, what else can he have? It seems now that we've got in chapter 18, acknowledgement from Jonathan that David will someday have the kingdom, and acknowledgement from Saul that that's problematic, that David may take the kingdom not only from his son, but even from him himself. And this drives him nuts. And in the next section there, the next day an evil spirit from God, in this case, rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house. We've seen this a couple times before, right? And this is this. So David came into Saul's house in two different ways. Once, because Saul hears that he's rejected and an evil spirit from the Lord enters him, and they call in David as a musician. And then in the next chapter, David comes in to fight Goliath, and they seem to be separate stories. So we seem to have merged the two stories here, the two traditions about how David's role in the house of Saul, and the administration of Saul as a musician and as a warrior, in verses 10 and 11. Is that last piece clear? Not quite. In this next piece, Saul takes, maybe a calculated political risk, but he's trying to put David in a place where he can't get to the throne, but he doesn't seem to understand the way to the throne in this situation. He puts him right out there in front, if someone would pick up in 12 through 16 and see where he puts the guy to get him out of the way.
And Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him and was departed from Saul. Therefore Saul removed him from him and made him his captain over 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. And David behaved himself wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. Wherefore, when Saul saw that he behaved himself very wisely, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before him.
This is the very thing in 1 Samuel 9, and the 1 Samuel 8, the last couple verses, that the people insist that they want from their king, someone who's going to go out before them in battle. And so he gets them out of the immediate administration gets him physically away from himself, but he puts him in the literally in the place of the king, the leader of the host of Israel. And they love him to death. Everybody loves his success, but David's also just charismatic, and he sounds like the glad handing, slapping on the back, kind of the happy and somewhat intelligent jock. Everybody just likes to be near him, and he's a real leader. When he goes out in front of us, we win. Saul seems to have miscalculated here where to put this guy to get him out of the way and protect his throne.
He thought he was setting him up for failure.
Very clearly in the next couple of verses, we'll see not only was he setting him up for failure, but setting him up for...
Sort of like he can't handle 1,000 troops.
Yeah. And that's... It takes some careful working through that I haven't been able to do yet, but I think... I know that some people have suggested that this is part of the David as a boy strain, rather than David as a real sort of a lucky boy strain, rather than David as the seasoned warrior strain. And if you want to talk about setting people up, let's go to 17 through 19. Anyone?
Then Saul said to David, "Here's my elder daughter, Merab. I will give her to you for a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." For Saul thought, "Let not my hand be upon him, but let the hand of the Philistines be upon him." And David said to Saul, "Who am I, and who are my kinsfolk, my father's family in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king?" But at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, she was given to Adriel, the Meholathite, for a wife.
Okay, so he sets him up. You can be the son-in-law of the king. Now, what's the son-in-law of the king? That's why you've got a nice manufacturing firm in a small town. You've got a pretty, bright daughter. She's dating the captain of the football team from state, local university. What's the assumption? And you have one son. What's the assumption about this kind of a marriage? Where is this bright, aggressive young man going to end up if he marries the boss's daughter?
Daddy's business.
It's going to be part of the business. And so it's a little bit ambivalent in my mind as whether he's trying to get him in. There's an old saying, keep your friends closer and your enemies closer so you can keep them in check. Or if he's holding out this promise that he never intends to fulfill, to get him to go out and be a crazy man in the battlefield to prove himself, to sort of earn this woman's hand. As we see at the end of this section, when the time comes, he gives her to someone else in marriage. And that was also probably a political alliance, someone else who would bring a certain number of troops or wealth into Saul's kingdom. So there's the one daughter, Merab. Becomes a piece of bait for David to get him even firmer into the warrior winner mentality. Let's string him out a little further. Get him to take on a little more. Sooner or later, things are going to fall from underneath him. His feet are going to fall from underneath him. And the Philistines will deal with him. I won't have to deal with him at all myself. Everybody loves him. I can't give him the axe, literally, in this case. That's what the situation is. Let's give him enough rope that he'll hang himself. It gets a little clearer in the next section just how frightened Saul is and what he's willing to do. Before we go to that, David's going to protest several times the idea of becoming part of the king's family. First one is here, who am I and who are my kinfolk, my father's family in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king? This is out of reach for me. I mentioned a couple of days ago that when Saul was called, he gave a similar response, even though he was clearly from a very wealthy family. And it seems to be the formal response to a generous offer that you wanted, or at least make sure that the offer comes again. Here, have a cigar. Here, have some caviar. Oh, no, I couldn't. I've always really wanted to try it. Oh, please, go ahead. Yeah. And this, it happens with Gideon, as he is called. He has a great give and take with God before he accepts the mantle of leadership. Saul does the same thing, and now we see David at the first step coming towards leadership, saying, I'm not sure.
But also, wasn't this the reward for killing Goliath?
Oh, yeah, you're right. This was supposed to happen. Yeah, I had completely forgotten that from him. That you're going to become, the one who rescues Israel will be the son-in-law of the king, as well as living tax-free, him and his family for the rest of his life. Pardon?
Entitlement program.
Entitlement. Would someone take 20 through 23, and we'll see the next time that this happens.
And now Saul's daughter Michal loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. Saul thought, let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistine may be against him. Therefore Saul said to David a second time, you shall now be my son-in-law. And Saul commanded his servants, speak to David in private and say, behold, the king has a delight in you, and all his servants love you. Now then, become the king's son-in-law. And Saul's servants spoke these words in the ears of David, and David said, would it seem to you a little thing to become the king's son-in-law, seeing that I'm a poor man and of no repute?
Okay. So this time again, specifically about himself, not calling on his lineage, but referring only to his lineage. I'm a poor man and of no repute. And again, Saul, one of the few, this is a rare thing in my mind that we get internal motivation in the Hebrew text. Again, over and over again with Saul in this narrative of we're going to let the Philistines deal with this guy and I won't have to do it myself.
This would make a great movie, I think, to me. I mean a really good movie, partly because of that.
Yeah. It's a great story. I always joke about how deprived New Testament scholars are because they have to teach without any good stories. And in the Hebrew Bible, they just roll along. So the price here is typical when one is to marry, to give a bride price in the ancient world. And the bride price here is pretty gross, as kids would say today. And someone want to pick up in 24 through 29. It is pretty gross. I'll read it then. The servants of Saul told him, this is what David said. Then Saul said, thus you shall say to David, the king desires no marriage present except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, that he may be avenged on the king's armies, on the king's enemies. Now Saul planned to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. I think we know that already. When his servants told David these words, David was well pleased to be the king's son-in-law. Before the time had expired, apparently there was a limit set on this, you do it by such and such a date. David rose and went along with his men and killed 100 of the Philistines. Hebrew Bible says 200 here. So he kills twice as many as needs, but apparently only collects the foreskins that he needs. And David brought their foreskins, which were given in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. Saul gave him his daughter Michal, or Michal as we call her, as a wife. But when Saul realized that the Lord was with David and that Saul's daughter Michal loved him, Saul was still more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy from that time forward. Let's close up the chapter here. Then the commanders of the Philistines came out to battle, and as often as they came out, David had more success than all the servants of Saul, so that his fame became very great. I've got up here the world, Saul and David, David and Uriah. You want to talk about a tragic figure in Saul? Saul has a great plan, go out and get me the foreskins of 100 or 200 Philistines, or 100, ask for 100, and David brings back either 100 or 200. It doesn't work. David just gets more famous. And not only does he not die, this time, you know, you can't say you're going to be my son-in-law. So this time, and since Michael is very interested, like, you know, Jonathan, we've seen his soul is knit to David's. You know, one son that's wild about him, a daughter that's promised, and then a daughter that's wild about him, at least at this point in the story. You can't, the second time, say in public, you're going to be my son-in-law if you do this and remain. So now we've got the guy who not only doesn't have the courtesy to go out there and die in battle, he comes back as in one way, legitimate heir to the throne. He's married into the royal family. He has some legitimate claim on the throne. David, Mr. Lucky, is in a real bind. He, in 2 Samuel, has seduced the wife of one of his personal bodyguard and impregnated her, and he remembers this trick. He doesn't bother to ask for the foreskins. He just sends them out, puts the poor man in the poor man's hand, the message for Joab that says, put him in the front of the line and fall back when the fighting is heavy. And then Uriah does have the courtesy to die in battle. So David is at least temporarily off the hook. Unfortunately, Nathan knows the whole story, and that's another nice story to read. And David is confronted and repents. So poor Saul has, you know, he's got a great plan. It just doesn't work for him, because apparently, as the story goes, God doesn't like him anymore, and is still angry for what to me appears to be a minor offense. So, any questions, observations so far about? What we've seen or said about, seen in the story or said about it?
Remind me, the minor offense is not?
Not waiting, there are two stories of Saul's rejection. One is that he performs the sacrifice before they go into battle. When he's been told to wait for 7 days, he waits 7 days and Samuel doesn't show up. And he performs the sacrifice, and as soon as he finishes the sacrifice, Samuel shows up and says, this is not what you're supposed to do. And it's part of the attempt in the story to separate political leadership from religious moral leadership. And the other piece is when he's gone out to battle and he doesn't slaughter everyone, including women, children, and actually brings the king back as a captive. And those are two different stories about the rejection. Saul gets rejected twice. So for not following Samuel, that is God's command to be a bloodthirsty warrior, and for sacrificing to God before going into battle, Saul is rejected. Things which, by the way, we see David do. You know, David shows mercy on occasion, and David makes sacrifices as the leader of the people. So let's move through 19. If someone would read 19, 1 through 7.
And Saul spake to Jonathan his son and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David, and Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, seeketh to kill thee. Now therefore I pray thee, take heed to thyself until the morning, and abide in a secret place and hide thyself. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where thou art, and I will commune with my father and thee, and what I see, that I will tell thee. And Jonathan spake good of David unto Saul his father, and said unto him, Let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he hath not sinned against thee. and because his works have been toward thee very good. For he did put his life in his hand and slew the Philistine, and the Lord brought a great salvation for all Israel. Thou sawest it and didst rejoice. Wherefore then wilt thou sin against innocent blood to slay David without a cause? And Saul hearkened unto the voice of Jonathan, and Saul sware, as the Lord liveth, he shall not be slain. And Jonathan called David, and Jonathan showed him all those things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence, as in times past.
Okay, so there's a sort of a reprieve. I think it's the King James.
Gideon.
Voice of God. There's a temporary reprieve here for David. Because Jonathan is wild about him. And Jonathan seems to have this prescience about, I don't want to be king, or I'm not suited to be king. You clearly are. And there's an undercurrent in the story that many people in Israel and Judah know that David is the one, including some of Saul's family, his servants, and Saul just can't deal with it. And here Jonathan is the one who delivers the word and actually commits an act of treason. You know, the king's enemy, king's state enemy, is protected by someone within the king's, not only the king's administration, but his own household.
How much do you think that was known about Saul's affliction and his demons?
You mean in terms of
probably?
Yeah. Oh, probably not much. were murmurings around.
Certainly in the court, though. And once the king looks like he's in, you know, ill or losing his powers or something, then you know, this sort of thing starts going on.
Yeah, I think especially in times of external stress, foreign policy problems, they continued to have with the Philistines. Did everyone hear that? That about the distrust of Saul because of his demon? And we're going to see another piece of confrontation here in 8 through 10. If someone would read those two verses.
And there was war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines, and made a great slaughter among them, so that they fled before him. Then an evil spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand, and David was playing the lyre. And Saul sought to pin David to the wall with a spear, but he eluded Saul so that he struck the spear into the wall, and David fled and escaped.
Mm-hmm. That night. So now twice, I mean, you got to wonder about David. Or you got to wonder about the connection of these stories. You know, he started off successfully as a music therapist, you know, soothing the king with his music. But now twice he's been in there playing when the king was in the state, and the king has picked up his spear and tried to pin him up against the wall. I don't know that I would come back to play again. It's a, as they say, a tough house.
Never try to play the harp for somebody who's got a spear hand.
And things heat up here now. We've seen Jonathan save David once, or at least push things off, and he'll literally act treasonously again and save David's life. Now we see Michael doing that. If someone would read 11 through 17.
Saul also sent messengers unto David's house to watch him and to slay him in the morning. And Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, If thou save not thy life tonight, tomorrow thou shalt be slain. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went and fled and escaped. And Michal took an image and laid it in the bed, and put a pillow of goat's hair for his bolster, and covered it with cloth. And when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, He is sick. And Saul sent the messengers again to see David, saying, Bring him up to me in bed, in the bed, that I may slay him. And when the messengers were come in, they were there. Behold, there was an image in the bed with a pillow of goat's hair for his bolster. And Saul said to Michal, why hast thou deceived me so, and sent away mine enemy, that he is escaped? And Michal answered Saul, he said unto me, let me go, why should I kill thee? So David fled and escaped, and came to Samuel to Ramah, and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and knelt at Naioth.
Okay. Thank you. So, you know, Michal deceives your father and says he was at threat of my life that I helped him. But, you know, she is clear, as the story is told, she is clearly the protector of this man about whom she's wine. Saul's kids are just wild about David. To their, as you read further, we'll see, to their own detriment, or at least to their own, to their own loss. David, in Jonathan's case, the potential for being king, and Michal loses out in another way. And Samuel shows up in the story again, at the end of what we just read, and this next piece is really pretty confusing for me. It's not clear to me if this is just a story about the place, or the inability of Saul to get at David, or Saul's legitimate part of the prophetic tradition, which he seems to have ignored or suppressed. Earlier, immediately after Saul's call, we see him fall into a prophetic frenzy. And here we see it happen again. And if someone wouldn't mind reading from 19 to the end of the chapter, about 6 verses. Saul was told David was at Naioth in Ramah. Then Saul sent messengers to take David. Now this is really hot pursuit. This is like those radicals in the 60s. The government was chasing and they had the FBI swarming everywhere to try to get them, and they keep moving from city to city. And when they saw the company of the prophets in a frenzy with Samuel standing in charge of them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also fell into a prophetic frenzy. When Saul was told, he sent other messengers, and they also fell into a frenzy. Saul sent messengers again a third time, and they also fell into a frenzy. Then he himself went to Ramah. He came to the great well that is at Seku. He asked, where are Samuel and David? And someone said, they are at Naioth in Ramah. He went there toward Naioth and Ramah, and the Spirit of God fell upon him. As he was going, he fell into a prophetic frenzy until he came to Naioth and Ramah. He too stripped off his clothes. He too fell into a frenzy before Samuel. He lay naked all that day and all that night. Therefore, it is said, is Saul also among the prophets? In chapter 9 or 10, where Saul is called, or first anointed, he leaves Samuel's presence and falls in with a band of prophets and falls into a prophetic frenzy, and this same proverb is quoted. Is Saul also among the prophets? And then now almost at the other end of his ministry, administration, when he's out to kill David and protect that, he falls into a prophetic frenzy, as do all of the messengers he sends out. I don't have much explanation for that. You know, that I think I presented the three possibilities that I can come up with. It's this place, or Samuel's power. It's Saul's legitimate prophecy. Another part of that would be in the third is that he suppressed that and separated that from the political leadership. And that's what has caused the problem. He's gone the way of other nations, which is what the Israelites asked for, rather than continuing in the prophetic leadership, military leadership mode that Israel, that had been successful for Israel. Yes?
In today's world, where is approximately Ramah?
It's down in the, in Judah, in the, let's see if we've got a map here. I can turn that to you. Judah's the, it's southwest, I believe, southwest of Jerusalem. If you go, just, if you can see this map, this is the Dead Sea, this is Jerusalem. It should be right in this area. I'm not exactly positive, but it's not far from Jerusalem. Have you got it on your map?
Yeah. It's a little bit northwest of the Dead Sea.
Northwest of the Dead Sea?
Yeah. Near Bethel.
I wonder if it's the same one. Ramah simply means high place.
Oh.
So there
are... Well, it mentions it in connection with Samuel.
Got it? Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. I was thinking northeast. Yeah, that's...
Mm-hmm. Here's where I think it should be.
Yeah. I'm not going there. So it's, yes. So why is it on here? Oh, it is on this map.
It's interesting. It... In terms of its location, it sounds like it could be where Ramallah is today. You're saying just north and a little west of Jerusalem.
No, south of Jerusalem.
Isn't it north?
Ramallah is, but I think he's saying Ramah is south of Jerusalem.
No, I thought it was, but it is actually north.
North.
Yeah. Up in Benjamin. In the land of Benjamin.
Interesting.
I was there. About 20 miles off, yeah. I guess. A lot of those names, as you know, have stuck and have moved from Hebrew to Arabic. It's not unusual to find the very similar names or neighboring cities, so ruins right next to it. There are cities that bear similar names. Did you have a question?
No, I was going to say, it seems both in this passage and the earlier, where Jonathan convinces Saul to the reprieve part, that Saul is genuinely torn about all this. I mean, that he's not of one mind.
No.
I mean, in one part, it seems like he's very calculating and he's going to get David. But in another part, he also seems to admire David or have some positive something toward him. Or...
Well, it may be that the one break that the story gives Saul is one that I find very difficult to deal with, and that is that this evil spirit comes from God, and that it's a madness. You know, he loves this guy, you know, in several places he loves him like his kids do, but this madness comes over, and the madness seems to be the what we would call legitimate concern to preserve the administration. I don't know where anybody's political, I have an idea up here, but I can never be quite sure. Political sympathies lie. When you want to re-elect the president, and you set up a committee to re-elect the president, how legitimate is it to try to keep the administration going? What will you do? You know, when we look back at Watergate now, that seems like madness. And if you wrote that story from the center or left, you could write the same story. An evil spirit from somewhere, and if you believe that God is in control of everything, an evil spirit from the Lord came into Jeb Stuart Magruder and Chuck Colson and, you know, Richard Nixon, and they went out after, who was it? I don't remember who it was. And they dug up dirt on everybody who was on the Democratic side, and they did do them in. I want to take a couple minutes to let you talk with one another today, though, and ask you to think about where you are and what your expectations are for your children or those people over whom you have influence or whom you are charged to be stewards of, and how difficult it is to hear their calling and their love for things that are other than what you have.